The government's been elected with a majority of seats off about a third of the vote. And while the trend away from Labor and the coalition overall, the major party vote, has been declining for quite some time, it's a long-term historical trend and it's part of a worldwide trend, really, has been going on for some time. Nobody thought it would quite dip this low. And if he can build that kind of consensus in an outside parliament, it makes for a transformed politics and a potentially a new, enduring, progressive coalition.
One for mum, one for dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The Treasurer knows.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast that explains big economic issues in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and today we are going to unpack the transformative election results we saw on the weekend.
Voting is now closing on the East Coast.
The early results are coming in.
Published polls were pointing to a big Labor win.
Tonight, the Australian people have voted for change.
There's a big vote there with others. There seems to be a lot of vote for independence scattered all across many seats.
Their numbers are set to swell. Eight new crossbenches are already confirmed after the teal wave swept across the country.
We can really speak for the community in terms of climate integrity and a future-focused economy.
And the Greens added more seats to their lower house numbers.
I think it's a very clear signal, though, that there is a role for third voices in Parliament, in both the Senate and the House.
Saw millions of voters decisively abandon the major parties and, as a result, transform our politics.
The coalition's vote collapsed across the country, and Australia now has a new Labor government with Anthony Albanese as the new Prime Minister. There's also more Greens and Independents elected to the crossbench, but there is so much more to unpack in this result. And joining me to read the political entrails today is Senate expert and Executive Director of the Australia Institute, Ben Oquist. G'day, Ben.
G'day, Eb. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So first of all, give us the big overview, Ben. What are the big trends that you can see that have come out of these election results?
Well, a truly transformative election, Ebony, in my adult lifetime, I think the most transformative. And the point you made in your introduction is well made. I put it this way. Anthony Albanese is the Prime Minister. He's likely to have a majority in the House of Representatives, a slim one only, you know, may get to 76, 77 seats indeed, but that masks a landslide that happened against the coalition. And we're looking at the lowest number of seats for the coalition since the Second World War, certainly in proportionate terms. Of course, the House of Representatives increased its size in 84. So less seats than they've had physically since that expansion of the parliament, and less seats proportionally they've had since the Second World War. So you've got a narrow win for Albanese on the kind of maths, but you've got a crushing defeat for the coalition. Put another way, we've got a supermajority in the parliament for climate action, even though Anthony Albanese is only theoretically just got over the line. But the win is much bigger than that. And the transformation of Australian politics is much bigger than that. A crossbench of that size and scale, of course, is unheard of in the parliament and the lower house. And with more Greens in there, a whole raft of new teal independents, and not forget the existing independents that have all held their seats, sometimes with much bigger majorities, is going to make for a very different dynamic in that House of Representatives. I know people are talking about what's happened, but if you just think physically how that's going to work in that chamber, when the Prime Minister Albanese looks across the chamber and sees the opposition, but he's also going to see a whole host of new faces and voices too. And I think that dynamic is going to have a big effect. And it's potentially a complete changing of politics in Australia, that there's a new supermajority against the coalition working there.
Yeah. As you said, it's just a huge kind of change. I mean, there's several things to unpack in that as well. Walk me through, to begin with, the collapse in the coalition vote, because it was absolutely extraordinary to see so many safe Labor seats, let alone the marginals where it was battling the Labor Party, so many safe blue ribbon seats just fall one after the other on election night. What's happened there, Ben?
Well, it's the rise of the Teals, Ebony. The coalition lost its base, and it lost it for a number of issues. But if you think about it this way, the Teals ran on three clear issues: climate, integrity, and women. And you can break it down to that, that the coalition got way out of touch with its base in key seats in the city. And while the election campaign started off with the idea that Labor might win by winning a swag of seats in Queensland, that strategy didn't work out. In fact, Labor won a swag of seats in inner metro areas, seats like Higgins or Reid, Brisbane, if they win it over the Greens. Those were the seats that more got them home than the seats in Queensland. And Labor benefited from that coalition collapse in those seats, as well as independents, as well as Teals. So the coalition lost a host of those seats to a range of parties, including the Labor Party, but not just the Labor Party, the Teals and the Greens. And it's really that collapse of that inner metro vote of the coalition being spread across a range of other parties, that is the big story of this election campaign.
The independents have crushed the Liberal moderates, particularly in those inner urban seats.
Our climate has changed. Yeah!
As strong professional women overwhelmingly convinced voters by challenging both parties to do more on climate change, government accountability and gender equality.
Well, I completely disagree with this entire panel, as you'd expect, and really think this was an enormous climate election.
To that issue of climate and integrity and the rise of the Greens and independents in particular, as you said, they all ran, including the Greens. They've had a long-standing agenda on integrity, for example, as well as climate, obviously. But those two issues, as well as women, were really key here. Walk me through the scale of the changes that we've seen, in particular with regards to the Greens picking up seats and those Teal candidates being successful against the Liberals.
Let's start with the Greens. They had big swings across the country. In fact, the biggest swing to them at a state level was in South Australia. But they ran a big targeted campaign on some seats in Queensland, effectively winning one seat off the Liberals and one seat off Labor, as the count stands at the moment. Still in the race in a couple of other places like Brisbane and McNamara and Richmond. But it was the huge surge to them in the right places in southeast Queensland near Brisbane that's delivered them extra representation in the House of Representatives. Although the swing was, you know, larger statewide in some other states, it was localised there for a variety of reasons. But they ran a big ground game there. And I think it really kind of demonstrates the lie that Queenslanders don't want action on climate change, that somehow Queensland is conservative. And there's through the election campaign, there was this talk of the Barnaby line, if you remember, that Barnaby wouldn't be seen south of some point, well south of Brisbane.
Yeah.
But it really misunderstands Queensland. Southeast Queensland and Brisbane is much like Melbourne or Sydney.
Mm.
The whole of Queensland doesn't not want action on climate change anyway. And the result for the Greens there, particularly in southeast Queensland, put a lie to that. And you know, a big achievement for Adam Bandt to elect new MPs in the House of Representatives like that.
Yeah, not a small thing for the Greens to take a seat from the Liberal Party, I would think.
No, but if you've been reading the trends that have been happening for a while, at state level in Queensland, they'd won a seat off the Liberals there. In the New South Wales election, they'd won seats off the Conservative side there. In Victoria, they'd won seats off the Liberals. As Adam said, you know, what's been going on has been hidden in plain sight.
Mm.
We also ran a really strong people-powered campaign. We knew we didn't have the big corporate money that the others had, so we ran a campaign that was based on conversations, community organising. In Griffith, for example, when the floods hit, they suspended the campaign and went and helped people clean up their houses. And this really strong people-powered approach that said politics can work for everyday people was a conscious strategy for us over a number of years, a different approach and doing politics differently. And people have responded.
That's going to change dynamics in politics for a long time. And on top of that, for the Greens, they've won senators across the country too, and they've got 12 senators in the Senate. We might get to the Senate a bit later, but that is a record for a minor party in the Senate. Then go the Teals. You know, going into the election, there were six key seats that people thought the Teals were a chance in, from Curtin to McKellar and places in between. Most people thought, you know, they'd win at least one. Some people thought as many as three or four, but very few people predicted they'd win all six. But if you think about it, if they were going to win one, the trends and factors were the same in each seat. So with a good enough ground game, which I think they had by the end, maybe not the start of the campaign, there were a chance in all of those seats, and that's what's turned out. And the electorates aren't all exactly the same, but they have some same dynamics. They are the safe, bluest, blue-ribbon Liberal seats around, you know. I found it hard to conceive the Treasurer would lose his seat just because intellectually it seems like a big thing for somebody as seemingly popular as Frydenberg and for a Treasurer to lose their seat. But did say a lot in the lead up to the election, I couldn't imagine, none of us could imagine John Howard losing his seat either, and he did, and so it's come to pass. That's a huge new crossbench, adding to the existing independent MPs as well.
Yeah, and I just want to stick with the two issues that really seem to be championed by the Greens and Independents in particular, and Labor as well to a lesser extent. Their focus was much more on, I think, cost of living during the campaign. But climate and integrity, Ben, I mean, they've just emerged as these two huge issues that didn't necessarily, I think, get the attention during the campaign that voters clearly gave them.
Yes, and I was struck by a couple of people talking this week from the Liberal side about what big issues they were for in reflecting upon the poor result, about why they lost. Senator Andrew Bragg, moderate from the Liberal Party in New South Wales, talking about how the government's failure on a federal ICAC was a key reason why they lost votes in those inner city seats. And while the federal ICAC wasn't Labor's number one issue, they certainly did prosecute it, and it helped them win some of those inner city seats like Higgins, you know, a seat that you might have expected to fall to the Teals. There's no doubt that Labor's a strong position on a federal anti-corruption watchdog and more action on climate change helped them win some of those seats as well. So the Teals won some of them, you're right, by focusing on climate and integrity and women's issues, but Labor was able to pick up some of them as well, which in the end has been critical for Labor to get to a majority government as well. But those Teals independents championed action on climate change, championed integrity, championed women's issues, all issues that obviously the coalition government and the Prime Minister in particular was seen as a laggard on.
And the first step to providing a solution is recognising the problem. The problem is wages aren't keeping up with the cost of living. A plan to address housing affordability through our Housing Australia Future Fund, a plan to address childcare, a plan to address wages, and we need to recognise that we need an economy that works for people, not the other way around.
I want to go now to Labor, the new government. I think during the campaign, as you said, they were still very strong on issues of integrity, but one of the big things for Labor was cost of living, and in particular issues like childcare and the stagnant wages crisis. I mean, how important is that overall, and in particular, I guess, now that they're in government, you know, facing $1 trillion in debt and rising inflation, those key cost of living things are still going to be top of mind for a lot of voters, aren't they?
They are. Start off with Ebony. There's been a lot of criticism that Labor ran a small target strategy and they didn't stand for much. I think that misconceives what's happened in this election campaign. They certainly didn't have as big a policy agenda as they went to the 2019 election, which obviously a big target strategy. I think they didn't have a small target strategy. I think they had a medium target strategy, yeah. Is what happened at this election campaign. And they had a more ambitious policy on climate change, quite thought through policy, not as ambitious as it will need to be to solve the climate crisis. They did have an agenda to intervene in some ways to try and lift wage growth in Australia, as you mentioned, and that was one of the turning points of the election campaign. You could clearly see the dynamic shift when the inflation figures came out and then the following interest rate rise, which really put the focus on the fact that people's real wages were going backwards and were going to go backwards even more.
Yeah.
And Labor was seen to have a solution to that, or at least to be trying to. And while elections are in the end about who wins and loses, who has the most seats, they're also about a contest of ideas and policies. And they speed up those policy debates. And some of those debates were won and lost in this election campaign.
Mm.
And sometimes you can win or lose a debate even if you don't win the election campaign per se in terms of number of seats. But one debate that was won and lost in my eyes was, on the one hand, Scott Morrison was prosecuting the idea that we'll just keep lifting the economy and lowering unemployment and we don't need to do any more and workers will be looked after.
Yeah.
Whereas Labor was really at its heart saying, no, we've had low wage growth for 10 years, record low wage growth for 10 years, and there needs to be government intervention.
Yeah.
So the debate about whether the economy will just lift wages or government should intervene was won by those arguing that government should intervene. Also on childcare, Labor's single biggest policy announcement in terms of dollars was their push to, well, not completely universalise childcare, but move towards that in quite a big way. I think that debate that childcare is an economic reform and is good for the economy overall was won during this election campaign. So I think some big policy debates were won and lost. There's a lot of things we didn't debate. We didn't debate Health March and we didn't debate COVID March.
Astonishing in the middle when cases are going through the roof.
And we didn't debate Tax March. Mm. But some important policy areas were won and lost. The case for a strong anti-corruption watchdog with teeth and more integrity was lost by one side and won by the other.
Yep.
And there's no way that this parliament won't deliver a federal anti-corruption watchdog with teeth. And it's been a long time in the coming, but despite Labor not having the numbers in the Senate and having just a majority of the slimmest of majorities in the House of Representatives, as we said earlier, there's actually a supermajority for action on integrity and a stronger federal ICAC. And I think that's one thing we can predict with confidence now. There's going to be a lot more integrity measures passed in the 47th Parliament compared to the 46th Parliament.
Yeah.
The Coalition's been accused of moving too far away from the centre and losing swathes of voters, particularly women who were fed up feeling like their government didn't listen to them.
So many Liberal women told me they did not see their concerns, their interests reflected in a party.
Looked as if we weren't being focused on fairness, kindness, support for minorities. I think we spent too much time in the election campaign talking about trans issues, for example. I think those are some of the reasons.
The other issue that we mentioned in relation to Teals and to Labor is women. And I think that is undoubtedly one of the other big features of this campaign was the prominence of women's issues, the focus on the treatment of women and the respect for women in politics in particular, and the... All the polls, and we'll find out the data afterwards, showed a big gap in support for the coalition government when it came to men and women.
Yep.
Our polling analysis consistently showed that the gap was kind of 8%, that the Prime Minister's support for men was 8% higher for women, and that's undoubtedly a key factor in his loss.
And just to finish up, Ben, the Senate, it normally doesn't get much traction until kind of the final week of the campaign, I find, but I know you study it closely and looks to be, as you said, a big change with 12 Greens at the very least on the crossbench there. Talk to me about the Senate result.
It is as transformative in a way as the House. And of course, all the focus is on the House. The House of Representatives is where governments are born and fall, and but it's the Senate that often determines what comes next. And we've got a transformed Senate. And like there was a collapse in the coalition vote in the House, delivering a massive loss of seats, there's been a big loss of seats for the coalition in the Senate. They currently have, under the existing Senate, 35 seats, and they're going to be reduced to 32 or something. But radically, what's happened is that the coalition has been reduced to such a number that, and the Greens' numbers have gone up and Labor's numbers have gone up slightly, that you've got at least between Labor and the Greens 38 seats in the Senate. 38 is exactly half, which is kind of classified as a blocking majority, and they could even get to 39 depending on the final count. And a couple of things have made that happen. One, the Greens have got a record cohort in the Senate, electing three new senators, and Labor's picked up three seats in Western Australia in the Senate. Listeners will know that at each election, six senators get elected. Labor's never won three seats in Western Australia, and they had a cracking result in the House of Representatives in Western Australia, but they also did in the Senate, and that's materially changed the balance of power. And then the other big news from the Senate was David Pocock getting elected in the ACT. The Territory senators have only ever returned senators from the Coalition or Labor in both the NT and the ACT, so a big breakthrough there. And then Jackie Lambie cloning herself and getting a new one elected in Tasmania. And then there's the personnel changes in the Senate as well as the numbers. Some key Conservative figures like Zed Seselja in the ACT, like Amanda Stoker in Queensland, and like Erica Betts in Tasmania have all lost. So numerically, the Senate's much more progressive, but in personnel terms, it is too.
Labor's vote went down, the Liberals' vote went down.
The whole two-party system fraying at the seams, is it gone now?
Look, it's been in terminal decline for some time.
Major parties have to be worried about the low primary vote, because what it means is that the major parties, Liberal and Labor, are losing their true believers. The people who have always voted Liberal, always voted Labor, they're going elsewhere.
And any final reflections, Ben?
That the government's been elected with a majority of seats off about a third of the vote. And while the trend away from Labor and the coalition overall, the major party vote, has been declining for quite some time. It's a long-term historical trend, and it's part of a worldwide trend, really, has been going for some time. Nobody thought it would quite dip this low. It had been at 75% between coalition and Labor. I thought it would drift a bit further, but it's dipped below 70%. It makes a very interesting dynamic to deal with, and I think that there's going to be a big debate now about how such alliances, and I don't just mean in the parliament work, but I mean more broadly. And the Prime Minister's big new opportunity and risk is that he's been elected with a low primary vote. He's got a slim majority, but there's a kind of super majority that he can appeal to on the floor of the parliament and in the community. And if he can build that kind of consensus in an outside parliament, it makes for a transformed politics and a potentially a new, enduring, progressive coalition, as opposed to the kind of literal one that exists with the Liberal Party and the National Party.
And we didn't even get into the future of the Liberal and National Party, which seems to be very contested at the moment, but perhaps we can save that for a future one. I'm sure the ramifications will be ongoing for a little while yet. That's all we've got time for today. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, the 24th of May, and things may have changed since recording. You can visit australiainstitute.org.au for all our latest research and content, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is ebony_Bennett with a double N double T, and Ben Oquist is at Ben Oquist. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and you can find her at Jennifer Macy, with additional editing by Louise Osborne. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Stay safe out there, and thanks for listening.